There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 590. At Midnight's going to New York next week, so our set will look different. The guests will be some people who've never been on before because they're on the far east coast from where we tape the At Midnight program, which is on the far left coast of the United States. It's impossible. It takes days by wagon, weeks even, to get from one coast to the other. So some of these people have never been on the program. So we're very excited. At Midnight from New York next week on Comedy Central. Which is Clive Barker. Now, this is a very interesting podcast because it's in two parts. The first part was recorded in September of 2013. Katie and I went to Clive's house, and which is amazing, by the way. It's so cool. There's like secret rooms, and there's like there's dick sculptures on the walls, and it's tons of his paintings, and it's the house is exactly what you would think Clive Barker's house would be. And so we went and met with Mark Miller, who is the vice president of Seraphim Films and who is one of Clive's closest. I mean, Mark's pretty much family. Mark's actually also part of the podcast. But here's the interesting story. A handful of months before this podcast from last year, Clive went to the dentist. Something happened. He came home and went into a coma. And it was a mystery illness, apparently. He doesn't know what happened, but he was in a coma, and he came out of the coma, and he was really messed up. And so he had essentially been convalescing in his home. And so a lot of this podcast is, in the beginning, is just talking about the story, because he hadn't really talked about it in depth. And we get about halfway through the podcast, and you know, he just wasn't feeling that great, because even just sort of getting up and getting around daily was difficult after the illness. And so he was kind enough to give us, you know, even I think like 40 minutes of his time. And he said, "Hey, you know, can we break this into two parts? Can you come back later?" And we said, "Sure." And just because our schedules weren't lining up, it was almost a year, close to the day actually, from the last time we were there. Clive was doing a lot better. He was painting all the time now. He's also been celebrating the director's cut of Nightbreed, which is out on DVD and Blu-ray now. They found all this footage that had been lost for 25 years and re-edited the film, because Clive wasn't really super satisfied with the way the original version turned out. So they, you know, he and Mark worked together, and they really just redid this film, and now it's out. And it was really an amazing journey with him, and how intimate he was willing to let us be in terms of what he went through and what he was feeling, and you know, how he was processing everything. And you know, you can really tell that Mark really is, I mean, they might as well be family. And so it was a very touching story, but Clive is a wonderfully sweet man, and it's sort of a testament to the indomitable spirit of someone who just must keep creating no matter what. You know, painting, writing, it's what's kept him going, and he's doing a lot better now. And so most of the way through the podcast, you'll hear the podcast chime, and that will signal the jump from 2013 to the check-in at 2014. So here's the Nerds Podcast with the very sweet and lovely and thankfully okay Clive Barker, who, by the way, drew a dick in my book. We have a podcast guest book, And I've been having everyone sign the guest book for the last couple months, and we're going to auction it off for charity at some point. So Clive drew a giant dick in the book. And then the next several things that people signed after that involved dicks, except for Nick Frost, who drew a vagina and then wrote actual size underneath it. So here's the Clive Barker podcast, number 590.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We're now in your main house. We were in your other house,
yes,
which was sort of the work castle.
Well, they're both work castles, really. They're just different kinds of work. This is the place where I write. This room is where I write, mm-hmm. and all my research stuff is here. All my texts are here. You know, past texts now, I paint and write here while I'm recovering from being ill. So I've had to sort of draw my horns in a little bit, mm-hmm. While I've been recovering. So because it's just everything is sort of, you know, when you get sick for anything, for any reason, everything is more effort.
Yes.
You know, and you just don't want to. I don't want to waste energy going somewhere. I prefer to stumble out of bed and literally go right behind you and start writing.
Right.
Or as today has been, because I haven't felt good at all, I'd just been writing, you know, here.
Yeah.
So there are little tests of how badly you really want to do this, I think. You know, I mean, I think all artists are tested all the time by how much do you really want to do this? Because I don't think there are many artists who would say, hand on heart, this is easy.
Yeah.
I just don't think there are. I mean, if they say it's easy, they're not. They're faking it.
Or something's wrong.
Yeah, something's wrong. Yeah, or the work's not good.
Right.
Right?
So you feel like you always have to be challenged, or it has to feel a little, like it should feel a little heavy lifting because you're pushing yourself all the time?
Well, that's, yes. I mean, there's a lot of what you said there that let's go through that a bit.
Okay.
Yes, I try and push myself, but, you know, there's a level at which pushing yourself too hard is just masochism.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I'm a masochist, so why not? I find when I push myself hard, the work is better. But on occasion, it can also be depressing. You get to a point of you can't push yourself so hard that you repeatedly fail, because that just puts you in a black place, in a dark place. So somehow or other, it's about judging your skills, I think, and saying, well, what can I reasonably achieve, you know? And you went to see some of the paintings next door, right?
Yeah, I saw there, which I can't even describe to people how many paintings there are. I mean, just like stacks and stacks and stacks of paintings.
There's about 1,000, I think, and most of them are in storage.
Yeah.
But the biggest of those is 25 feet long and 12 feet tall.
Yeah.
That's at the very limit of what I could do as a single person. You know, a 25 foot painting, 12 by 25, was just like, okay, this is as much as I could ever do. And those numbers of paintings were, I think, as much as I could do. I mean, they really squeezed me dry.
Yeah.
On the other hand, having done them, I felt like, well, now I have the basis to tell a huge story, because they were illustrations for a book or books, as it turned out, 5 books, the Aberrat series, which I did not know I was going to write until I started painting these pictures. And then the pictures appeared, and it seemed like, these want to be something.
They want to tell more of a story.
Absolutely. And they wanted to tell a different kind of story to the stories I'd hitherto been telling, which were very, very dark.
Do you write to get away from painting, or paint to get away from writing? Or, like, is one of them a break, or are they both work, or are they recreational anyway?
None of it's work.
None of it's work.
None of it's work. I've never worked.
Well, that's good.
You don't work, do you?
No, I don't feel like I do. As a matter of fact, I just constantly feel like I shouldn't be allowed to do what I...
Somebody's going to tap you on the shoulder.
Someone's tapping you on the shoulder.
Right, I know that feeling. Yeah. Chris, what do you think you're doing?
Exactly.
Where's your certificate of merit?
This won't do at all.
Yeah.
Put it down.
And how did you get into it just by passing? I mean, what here you are, very successful. What made you think, I'm going to trust myself?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was always a huge comedy nerd, and so... I always wanted to pursue comedy, and my parents were very supportive, and my dad left home when he was 17 to go do what he wanted to do, and so my parents were not, they didn't have kind of the typical mandates of their generation, which was like, oh, no.
Right.
You can have a hobby when you're young, but then when you're older, you take a shitty job. Like, they were very much like, you have to make yourself happy. So they're responsible for a lot of why it even occurred to me that I could do my own
thing.
That's
awesome, isn't it? And rare, I think.
Yeah, well, at least certainly at that time, I think now this generation, everyone's like, hey, do whatever you want, more so than when I was growing up.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I'm not sure that's true. I have a daughter of 24 going on 25, and I think a lot of her contemporaries are under the same pressures that you would have been under if you had less good parents.
Yeah, I guess
that's
true.
I mean, the economy is for shit, and under those circumstances, I think, loving parents say, no, don't do something dangerous. Do something, cautious. Because you don't... I don't mean physically dangerous. I don't mean working on an oil platform. I mean, don't do anything that's going to risk your...
But ironically, I feel like taking... Doing work that you hate or staying in a situation that you hate is actually more risky.
I agree, but I don't think the older generation necessarily sees it that way.
No.
I think, they tend to say, well... Probably if you hate it, it's good for you.
Yeah. But I also think that because people have such a direct connection to masses of other people, through the internet, that it's better, even though the economy is shit, I still feel like there are a lot of opportunities for people who want to reach people and do their own thing.
Yes.
More so than there would have been,
more.
15, 20
Huge
years ago.
Or ways to sell your skills.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you still come back to the fact that the economy is shit. There's only so much money.
There's only so much money that people can give you for things. Yeah.
I think if you're willing to take the hugest risk is, I'm going to do this until it works for me.
Yeah.
And I'm never going to turn away from this. I'm always going to do this. I'm going to be like a rabid dog. I'm going to hold on to this with my teeth fixed, and I'm not going to ever let go. I never worked for the man. You never worked for the man. But that was a hard thing to do. By the time I was reaching almost 30, I was beginning to get very, very anxious that I was not only never going to work for the man, I was never going to eat.
Well, that's a scary... Yeah, that's when you're approaching 30, if you hit 30 and it's like and you don't feel like it's quite clicked,
gelling, right?
Yeah, that's sort of scary because that's the number where people are like, 30, huh? You gotta figure this shit out. But I still think that, because I think a lot of people go, but what if I pursue it my whole life and it never works out and I'm just an idiot for pursuing it? And then I kind of feel like, well, wouldn't you rather go through and be hopeful rather than just let your hope die? And then, sort of live half a life not pursuing
what you want. Point taken, but living with the death of your hope is not absolutely great either, I think.
Right.
I think living your life knowing that you wanted something greater and you've never achieved it.
Right. Yeah.
Not great.
No, I think we're saying the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I would never, for whatever reason, when I was, sort of approaching 30... And then 31, I would, kind of do these sort of like Ebenezer flash forwards.
Right.
And see yourself.
Future.
Yeah, Chris's future. You're like, 75 years old, and then you're just sitting somewhere, and you can't really do, what you want to do. And then you're like, oh, if I'd only just,
What would that only just have been?
Well, if I'd only just not been afraid to stick it out or pursue the things that I want or just try to make it happen. What if I, Because I feel like I always have a big fear of regret.
The worst.
Yeah, the fear of future regret.
Yeah, I never want to lie on my final pillow and go, shit.
Yeah.
If only I had done.
Yeah.
And
Craig Ferguson
said... good women.
Craig Ferguson said something. Craig, if only I had had a spy closet. Craig Ferguson said to me that he never regretted... How did he word it? It was really great. He said he never regretted going down a path or trying something, like, as opposed to not trying something.
Well, you can't tell you. I mean, it would be foolish to after all, you've taken the path.
Yeah.
You know? I think the only bad path is the path which dissuades you from taking other paths.
Right. Because you can, you know, you can get safe, and I guess the more success...
Terror makes you safe. Fear makes you safe.
Yes, and of course, and which... You know, I think it happens to a lot of people. The older you get, or the more successful you get, it's like, oh, I don't want this to go away, and so then people stop taking risks, or they get comfortable, and you know.
I'm lucky. I'm too stupid to do that. I continue to, you know, branch off into other places. You know, so writing horror, and then writing fantasy, then writing for kids, and then painting, and then making some movies, and writing some plays. And, you know, we got to, you know. A play is going into rehearsal right now for next year, a big play, and you know, I made some movies. Yeah, you know, I dance around everywhere, and you know, that's a recipe for failure, obviously, because you're not gonna, not everything's gonna work.
Sure, but well, I think it's your diversifying, which I think you have to do.
And I think that's been the lesson of the culture. The zeitgeist has been about diversification.
Absolutely.
For the very reasons you talked about. You know, the internet being able to sort of show us options, various options we may not even have thought about,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've certainly, I've become more courageous. We as a company have become more courageous about publishing the work ourselves, for instance. You know, and we're looking into making some movies ourselves rather than having to go to these big studios who, you know, don't really share the vision.
No. No, they don't.
Yeah.
But I think, I feel like it was a... Maybe in the mid-2000s, I'm not like a stock guy at all, but I, you know, one day I was in a bookstore and I'm like, oh, I'm going to learn about stocks. Why not? By the way, I still haven't learned about stocks.
Oh, okay.
So I, you know, I read a couple of books, and then, you know, I kept seeing this, you know, like diversification thing. And so and that other sector was, yeah, that's right about when I started. And so then I was kind of like, oh, well, why couldn't you do that with, you know, your career? Like, why does it have to be money? Why couldn't you do that with your life?
And have you done that, do you think?
Yeah, there's no question.
Yeah.
There's no question.
And it's been good for you, obviously.
It's been good, yeah. Because the good thing about career diversification, which doesn't happen with stock diversification, is that oftentimes if the water rises,
right,
then in one area, right, then everything kind of goes up. So
right,
it's so that's good. But you, just in terms of, like, with fear, yeah, speaking of what to be afraid of, you, it's kind of got through the scariest thing anyone could ever have to go through, with the illness and the coma. And I would love to talk about it with you a little bit.
The short version is probably as easy as anything. There's a thing called toxic shock syndrome.
Yeah, TSS.
Right? And I went to the dentist, which is a common way for males to get toxic shock. And 2 hours later came home and didn't even have anything really bad going on at the dentist. It was a checkup, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Cleaning or something.
Very routine.
And collapsed. And woke up 3.5 weeks later.
Oh, my God.
And three strokes, and then went into a coma.
Oh, my God. Three strokes. Were you aware that this was happening as it was happening, or you just...
I was aware when I came out of it, for the 3 days that I came out of it, that I would be delivered into living hell, because I had 10 IVs in me and three tubes up my nose and down my throat. And when you wake up and that's what's going on, you can't swallow and you can't breathe properly, and there are all these people with masks walking, because I was in ICU, walking around whose faces you can't see and you've never met before. I thought I was being tortured by either human beings with bad complexions or aliens. And, you know, that I was... It was horrible. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't swallow. I kept loosening my straps. And I eventually managed to do it labially. I actually managed to get some of the stuff away using my mouth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, by getting the tubes out of my throat by just regurgitating them.
Did they put you back under at that point?
Yeah.
They did?
Yeah. Yeah,
did you find him?
No, I was getting the text messages in real time saying something's going on. Meet us here. You know, we're being loaded in the ambulance now. He's having a seizure, and it was terrifying. This, you know, this is right after Christmas.
Yeah,
it
wasn't great.
Yeah,
it wasn't great, and it's left me. I've left the house 5 times since I got out, which is 19 months ago.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
19 months? So what is... I mean, I'm sure a lot of people, you know, we have sort of a... We have what you would call a nerdy community who listens to the podcast. I'm sure there are a lot of hypochondriacs out there. And so to hear, like, oh, fuck, going to the dentist can do that? Well, fuck that. I'm never going to... Like, what was it? Did anything specifically happen? Or is it just... No.
There's bacteria in our bodies which, you know, which gathers in large amounts in various places, and sometimes it can be loosed quite accidentally into the bloodstream. And if it goes into the bloodstream in sufficient amounts, the blood sort of convulses, the body convulses, and there is systemic breakdown. The whole system goes, we're out of here, bye. And the chances of actually losing your life are very high. And when I actually did come out of all of this, 7 doctors who I was being looked after by 7 doctors each came in one by one and said, you should be dead. You should be dead. You should be dead. Absolutely just, right?
Well, yeah, every day I came, I thought, you know, I thought you'd be dead.
Yeah.
That was a nurse. That was the comforting thing.
Yeah, the doctors would say, you know, we expected an empty bed every day.
Oh my God. And did you, you weren't aware of anything at the time.
Oh, like I was when you came up, and then you know, I'd lost 35 pounds, mm-hmm. and I was incredibly weak. I couldn't stand. It was really, really rotten. and then you know, my fans, my readers, have been either wonderful or terrible.
Terrible, how so?
Well, some of them say they don't care that I've been ill, they just want the next book.
And then if you're like, when I've been sick, they're like, I'm just a fan. You're like, yeah, I know, but you got to give a guy a chance to recover.
And there are a lot of people who completely understand. They say, you know, take your time, do it in your own time, do it the way you need to do it.
Yeah.
But there are an awful lot, Mark, and this is not true, who are just, you know, willful sons of bitches who say, we don't care about your illness, just write the damn thing.
Oh, wow. How long before you were able to... How long before you could actually start writing again after the ordeal?
It was the next day.
With tubes?
It wasn't very good.
Well...
But that's why, yeah, I had to get back on the horse immediately. I mean, but, you know... And it's interesting, because I have been out of the house so little... I've written every single day since coming out of hospital. So that's 19 months of writing. And, you know, I'm obsessive, but it does keep me sane.
Well, Mark was saying that he'll sit down with you and you're writing one book with your left hand and then writing the children's book with your right hand and then doodling in the margins and then also pitching a movie idea with your mouth.
And you don't want to know what I'm doing with my dick. You know? It's like that can also have a paintbrush tied to it.
Oh, that explains why you're able to get so much done.
Exactly.
You have a prehensile cock, which is... Okay, good.
Just lean the canvas against the right angle.
There was a dick mold above a door in the other place, and I asked...
Say nothing. That's the one.
Don't speak.
Well, if you were the origin of that, then bravo, my friend.
Is this the one I've said?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's
say, you're a gifted man.
Gifted man.
After the people under the stairs, the next one is the dick above the
door. Well, actually, you know, Renoir, the painter Renoir, had very advanced arthritis right through the last 10, 15 years of his life. And he always used to say, it wasn't true, but he used to say that he had his paintbrush attached to his erection. And this is a man who was in his 80s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, there is a drawing, an illustration behind your head right now that is a boner with a flower in it.
It's a beautiful picture.
It's a great picture.
Yeah. Why? Who needs vases? Right? But no roses, please.
No roses. Oh, yeah. No roses.
Special occasions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Saturday's open. Yeah. Can we take a brief break?
Yeah.
Hey. What's funny about that picture is there's so much detail in this, you know, a rocking detail in this.
Yeah.
And I managed to get that through my publishers without anybody commenting on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was very funny.
Well, I guess if you build up a certain amount of cred at some point, they're going to be like, yeah, it's Clive.
Yeah, but they didn't know me at that point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so you're right, of course, if I had built up that amount of cred, but I actually hadn't. That was just I was a neophyte, and... But I think it was something different. I think it was the English are too embarrassed about sex to mention it.
So they just didn't.
What sex? You know?
Oh,
and
no.
there's pussies, there's cocks, and there's buttholes in, you know, all of it. You know, we're talking about, you know, 20 or 25 such orifices in the picture.
But then also that sort of, like, I mean, this to me really kind of... So, like, if I saw that picture, I would say, oh, that looks like a Clive Barker thing, because it's got the erotica, but it also has the skin and, like, the brain,
right.
and then that sort of, like, gothic medical...
Well, the story is called The Age of Desire, and it's about an aphrodisiac which gets out of control.
Yeah.
And it's a really... You know, I've always brought more sex into horror than... I always brought more sex into horror than I think probably anybody had before me.
Yeah.
And I wrote it graphically, you know. It wasn't written sort of in a sort of delicate, oblique kind of way. And so when I was doing the covers, I thought, you know, I really want to make one painting which represents that kind of sexual energy. And Age of Desire, you know, is about this guy who has this experimental aphrodisiac in him, which is multiplying in terms of its effectiveness by the hour. Every hour it doubles in power. So his vision of the world becomes increasingly eroticized. It isn't, you know, it's women and then it's men and then it's boys and then it's, you know, and then it's chickens and then it's doorsteps and then it's... And by the end, I'm not kidding, by the end of the story, he has basically eroticized everything in the world. It's a story about the sanctity of what is erotic, and that really, if we want to open our minds broadly enough to the possibility of what is tactile, what is joy-giving, what is sexy, anything can be sexy if you are open-minded enough.
Now, did you know you were writing? Did you know that that's what it was that you were writing in those terms, or did you finish it and go, "Oh, I guess that's what this is about"?
Usually, about halfway through, something dawns on me that I have a vague idea that this is the parameters of the story. Obviously, if you're writing about an aphrodisiac which gets out of control, it's going to be about sex.
Yeah,
but the story is very life enhancing. I think, right?
Mm.
Yeah. It's about a man who is becoming more and more open to the world and less himself.
Mm-hmm.
He is less and less relevant as an individual, as a person. Like the greatest sex in the world, sort of in our lives, erases us to some degree, doesn't it? We roll away from the beloved and lie on the pillow feeling marvelously indifferent to being ourselves.
Oh, I never thought of it that way. I never thought of it that way at all. I guess you're just—it's just all the chemicals, just sort of in your brain, or just kind of.
Yeah,
like,
well, they are. They call it the French call it the petit bourre.
Right, of course.
And you know what is that about? If it isn't about erasure, about the gentle, comforting feeling that it isn't that important to be me.
That's really interesting that you sort of lose your So
you
lose your individuality, yes, to this like collective sexual consciousness.
Yeah, and firstly, the first gift is to the other, is to the beloved. So the beloved is giving to you, you're giving to the beloved, and there's a sneering, there's a gentle, loving. I don't want to say erasure because that's too strong, but yes, a smearing of taking two pastel colors and rubbing them together to get a lovely third one.
Yeah.
Which doesn't have a name, you know, because it's not a person anymore. It's just a being. It is being.
Would you say that Hellraiser was my first... Hellraiser, right, was my first, and for a lot of people too, sure, I would imagine. You know, that movie, I saw every Hellraiser movie. I fucking love the Cenobites. I love Pinhead. Pinhead's a really shitty, hard character to cosplay as.
right.
I've seen people do it. Like, I've been to, I've been to masquerade balls, and if you see a Pinhead, you're like, oh, fuck, that guy's serious, because that's really hard to do.
Yeah.
But there is that sort of... you know, the pleasure and the pain and being ripped apart. They're basically, would you say that they're, are the Cenobites like torture demons, or are they sexual demons, or what is it that they represent?
Well, I think they represent the extremes of sensuality. What happens if you push your definitions of desire to places which are less brave souls would not go?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we do that. You know, human beings do that. I mean, there's a certain kind of human being who you know, won't get out of the missionary position ever.
Right?
Let's go earlier. There's a certain kind of human being who doesn't have sex at all. You know, but, you know, people in the monasteries and nunneries, you know, and the Vatican. I've heard. But then there's another kind of human being who is very conservative about the sexual options, and then, you know, there's a rolling wheel of possibilities which gets more and more ambitious for what the body can do, what the senses can do, and I think everybody has a different place they will go or different places they will go. I think as we grow older, we maybe find ourselves open to options that we wouldn't have maybe in thought too much about an earlier age. I just think that there's something joyful about the body. The body gives us great pain, of course, and great reasons to panic and so on. But if we only look on the dark side, if we only look on that side, then we're only seeing half the picture, aren't we? The body also gives us joy, it also gives us bliss, it also gives us reason to celebrate. If it's only just looking across at somebody who's naked who you think is beautiful when naked, that's a wonderful thing. And I think it could not give us that degree of pleasure if it did not also have to give us pain. They're tied together.
I think people will try to avoid pain more than they'll get pleasure.
Of course they will, but it's not about avoidance or anything. It's what the fact of what you've got.
Right.
You know, it's no use trying to avoid it. It's going to come anyway.
Well, just with where your brain goes and thinking of like someone solving the puzzle box, and then all of a sudden these shoop, 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 all right, these hooks and tubes, and then cut to you're in a hospital, and then you have all this shit hanging out of you. I mean, it must have sort of seemed like, did I write this? Am I imagining this? This is like,
you know,
this really
never,
horror.
It never did. Now, only now, 19 months later, you make that connection. I think that's a very smart connection Chris made. It never even occurred to me, but you're right. You're absolutely right. I should have made that connection. But I can make a very clear distinction in my head between what is fantasy and what isn't. I mean, otherwise I think you'd go nuts, you know? I mean, you've got to keep everything in place, haven't you? Otherwise I would go nuts if I couldn't distinguish clearly between, oh, well, this is fantasy, this is reality.
So the entire 3 weeks that you were under... you don't remember any, there was no dream, there was no, it was basically just a state of non-existence.
Yes, exactly. Which is a bit disappointing, I think.
Because you hear the stories of people like, oh, I was transported to this other dimension and I...
Nothing.
damn it.
Yeah, I know. Now, that isn't to say I didn't have the experience and forgot about it.
Sure.
You know, but no, nothing.
But let's Occam's razor this for a second.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't, you know.
It's a great sadness to me that I never mentioned anything, did I?
The only thing that you mentioned was after coming out, you had a hallucination based on that film.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, that was more than a hallucination. That was when I was here, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I almost died a second time here when I came back here, right?
Yeah.
The following Friday, was it?
Yeah, because we brought you home and you went right back to it, and then you collapsed again.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, well, entirely my own fault. But it was the Friday... maybe a week after.
Yeah, about.
And I was lying in this bed in this corner, and this is not my normal sleeping place, but at that point I couldn't get upstairs and downstairs, and my dogs wanted to be with me, and I wanted to be with my dogs, so it just seemed to be better to keep me down here for a while. I'll eventually go back upstairs again when I feel well enough, but we're not there yet, so... I remember lying in this bed and a whole bunch of things coming together really one of the very few nightmares I've ever had. I've had so few nightmares in my life, or things that I would define as a nightmare. Mm-hmm. This was, this is as bad as it gets for me anyway. And if I'm being coy about saying what it was, it's because it's going to be a book, and I don't want to spoil the contents, because some of it was very, very personal. This part I can't tell you. I dreamed I was dead in bed here, and I dreamed that outside a large gang of my followers and my friends and my fans and my family had assembled, knowing that I was dead. And then I actually got up from the bed, walked through everybody who was in the room, because I knew about half a dozen people in the room at that time, right? Mm-hmm. And I walked out of the house unnoticed, through everybody, and out into the street. And it was very, very windy. It was the evening. It was very windy and cold, and which it was at the time. Right, it was March or whatever. Right,
the great gray beast.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I had seen a movie which Mark had lent to me called
Education for Death.
Which is, do you want to tell us
what is Education for Death?
It's a short film that was an anti-Nazi propaganda film, and it's about the process by which the Third Reich would train your children to become Nazis.
And it's terrifying.
So it was stay away from Germany, stay away from that threat, because all they're going to do is teach your kids for death. And the final shot is millions upon millions of adolescent children marching in the full Nazi regalia.
Oh, Jesus.
But along the way, a number of the Third Reich, high command turn into various animals. They turn into pigs. They turn into goats. They turn into. It's quite like the Night on the Bald Mountain sequence from Fantasia. Do you remember that sequence? You know, where the devil gathers all these things up from hell and they dance on his hands.
Yes,
you know. That's exactly the same imagery. It's interesting it was made at the same time, 1941, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And Disney.
And Disney,
of course, yeah. And they were carrying carts full of corpses. They were pulling carts full of corpses. I cannot emphasize how strong this imagery is. I wish we had something to show, Chris. We don't have it, do we?
No.
I'll dig it up online.
Yeah.
The internet will not fail me. I'll find it.
This will make a lot more sense when you see it. The color values, everything is just incredibly dark and grim. And so I take that imagery, I go outside into the street, and what I find is there's a factionalizing going on outside. There's a battle going on between my people, my mourners, my celebrants, and the forces of evil, who are culled from the movie. And it was horrible. And when I woke up, I could still see some elements. I could still see vultures in the room, in this room. So I was still having that part of it carried over into reality. And I was lying here, basically hallucinating over, you know, God knows what my temperature was. And I wasn't making much sense, was I? No.
Was it just a fever hallucination, or like from the drugs, or from the coma, or would you have any?
There were so many reasons it could have been. I don't think it was from drugs, because they were, you know, I don't know what drugs I was on. I suppose I was on a lot. I don't know.
Yeah, there was just
this. I don't know, but I doubt they would have. I think it was an imagination which had been, you know, was released into a place where it needed to act again. What are you looking at?
It's showing me imagery from the film.
I forgot I put it on my Instagram.
Just the little kids. See
highlight. Are the animals? Are the animals here?
I can Google it.
Would you?
Yeah.
Well, just, you'll understand hugely how this imagery worked, because this is a dark room, but it's a dark room full of images I like.
Well, and not only that, but this is a room that I assume you spend most of your time in right now.
All my time.
No, there's really just kind of a modest-sized television over there. Your computer's over there. I don't see a laptop, but what I do see is a lot of papers and a couple different notebooks.
I handwrite everything.
You handwrite everything.
Yeah. I always have. Every novel is handwritten, every poem or whatever.
Oh, yeah, Mark showed me the original Hellbound mint.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Fucking awesome. But did it change? I mean, up to that point, you know, everything was going in one direction, I'm sure.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden,
you mean after
everything's dramatically changed, and do you still feel like yourself, or does the pre-coma Clive feel like, oh, that was kind of a different guy? This has changed me in this way.
Very, very, very smart question, and it's a very, very hard one to answer, because I'm not who I am. I think it's hard to answer what I was.
Right.
I think you need to ask a third person. I think you need to ask Mark, because I think Mark was there for. You know,
I mean, it's tough because I think we all changed. It was
yes.
There is nothing.
Well, talk about that.
There is nothing now that is the same as it was then.
Go on.
It was a tough time.
Oh god. For everybody.
Yeah.
So everyone essentially changed at the same time. So it's difficult to.
Yeah.
Well, everybody assumed, including me, that I was not going to make it. I was going to die, and so. Even when I came back, you know, there were still a lot of people saying, you know, you got to be very careful, Chung, because, you know, it would only take one misstep and you'd be down. And,
Does that scare you, or are you sort of like, nah, fuck it, at this point, I've already kicked, you know, I've already gotten past it?
Pretty much that. Yeah, I wouldn't say fuck it, but I would say I am cautious, I'm more cautious than I was, but I feel like I've survived this one. And I think it was a tough one to survive. It really was. Yes?
Yeah. But we fucking made it.
and the we is important, because I would not have done this were it not for, you know, my lover Johnny and for this man. And I was surrounded, and for my daughter. And they were with me for weeks. Weeks. A lot of the time I was speaking and I wasn't making any sense, and I was coaxed back to the land of the sensible by the loving hearts of people who put me ahead of themselves, which was would make me cry even now if I wasn't, you know, in company. That's a big thing that's changed. I am a much more empathic man than I used to be, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I care a lot more about looking at other people's situations because I realized when I got so sick that I was being, that a lot of people were sacrificing a huge amount that I would not die. They were sacrificing the rhythms of their lives, their love affairs, their, you know, all kinds of other things. And that remains very moving. You know?
And so does part of you sort of feel like, not just for yourself, but you want to sort of get, you know, get well for them and make it better?
Yeah. In fact, that's the only reason to get well. I don't do a lot of press. I don't do a lot of first-person singular talking.
Sure.
You know, I'm not interested in that terribly. This is the first time I've talked about this, for instance, after 19 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done a piece of press.
The Guardian asked right when you came out.
Say again?
The Guardian asked when
right.
you came out and
right.
said, no. you know, we're not ready for that.
Well, this is a good way to do it because it's your words and it's the way that you
right.
want to tell the story. It's not a media outlet kind of taking the
right.
bits that
and
they want to
the
build
word.
A story.
Yes,
this is
yeah.
just you saying
yeah.
this is, I mean,
yeah.
almost probably slightly therapeutic in a way, but also for your fans.
I mean, yeah,
I
mean, you know, there's been so many misrepresentations, so many people saying the wrong things, telling it the wrong way. It's quite nice to be able to put it the right way. It's lovely to have Mark here because he is the other part of this equation. You know, it's people do not live and die alone. We live and die as part of a cabal, a little clan, either a family or I suppose in its simplest, a relationship between you and your lover or you and your dog, you know? But you do, you know, everything, you see life in the eyes of those who love you, your life in the eyes of those who love you, and you see your death in the eyes of those who love you.
When you were at the hospital, it's like 2 weeks in, so he's still a week out or so from
surfacing.
From surfacing.
Yeah.
At that point, were you still hopeful, or were you starting to feel like... Oh.
There was no... It was weird because he's like a force of nature. And, you know, you don't... I can't, and I still can't, even though I have the image in my mind, I can't picture him not being here or not being,
That's a really interesting point of view. That must be sort of... Boy, what a way to kind of... face your own mortality through this person that you're like, well, fuck, if it could happen to that guy.
Exactly. Like,
what fucking chance do I have?
He's the guy that's supposed to be invincible.
Well, that's
yeah.
right. Well, he kind of is because he's still here and,
he won't
you know,
go
he's...
I did kick Johnny across the ward.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's true. One of the first day he came out, he kicked Johnny in the ass. His boyfriend, he's by his side. He's like, baby, you're coming too. And Clive, because he's hallucinating and he just goes, get away from me! And he just starts kicking it.
Which ironically was probably a very positive sign. Hey, he
yeah.
can move,
look at
he
this.
Can kick.
He's back.
He's gonna
and
be
Johnny,
okay.
Johnny was shocked but not offended.
Yeah, no, of course not.
You know, I guess the guy's back, you know. I'm getting tired, guys. I'm sorry I am. Can we do this in two bites? Is this possible to do? Do you live a long way away?
No, not that far.
Because I feel like I'm losing my energy.
That's totally fine. You know what? That's actually a great idea because...
It seems like we talked about one thing.
We talked about one thing.
Another thing to talk about.
Let's schedule another time, and then we'll come back, and then we'll talk about the stuff you're working on now. We'll talk about writing. We'll talk about that kind of thing.
Yeah. Is that okay?
And then tag it together. I think that'd be great because I'd rather have the time to get into that than cut it short and not have. So I'm glad that you wanted
okay.
to come back.
And I'm glad that you gave me the chance to talk about this with you guys being so witty and Mark being here and a sense that it was being treated seriously, but not too seriously, you know, that we could all have a laugh at it because I'm still alive in the land.
Well, it's, you know, it's that when people are like, now let's just take it. Then you're like, oh, please.
Yeah, yeah,
then
yeah.
you fucking, didn't I go through enough of that
yeah,
shit?
Yeah, of course.
But so wonderful and so fascinating. And I appreciate that you're willing to talk about it. And I think people are going to really.
Well, I think, you know, which absolutely tell you the truth, nobody has what happened in the detail that we've just explained it to you. So this really is a first time, and an older time, actually. I won't talk about it again after this.
It's been a year since we were here, which I can't believe. It's
yeah,
been like a year.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And you're getting around a lot better than
yeah,
you were.
I was not doing well
back then.
A year ago, yes, absolutely.
So how are you feeling now?
You know, I still have some issues, health issues, but I'm getting better.
Did they ever figure out nothing? No?
No. No. Just goes on going on. But let's not talk about health because it's just so depressing.
Yeah, of course.
but yeah, I mean I am getting better, Mark, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean look at all the shit we got coming in.
Yeah.
Well, you basically this room before was sort of was almost like a makeshift lounge room.
Right.
And now this is actually this looks like your bedroom workspace.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And you know, I've got a lot of projects which are, you know, in progress,
yeah.
You know, drawings. Since I saw you, I've probably made about going, yes, Mark.
How many paintings?
Is, yeah.
Oh, since you saw 1,000? I mean, that's conservative. That's probably
a lot of images.
Yeah, at the very least, 1,000.
Not this size, I should say.
No.
Not this big. Not as big as the 4x3 behind me, but nevertheless, big pictures, I think, you know?
Do you just get up in the morning and you start drawing and painting until you go to bed?
Pretty much. I mean, it's no use me planning those things, because planning those things just always ends up in disaster. If I plan stuff, it doesn't work. So I have to just let it be, take its own time.
Yeah. And how have you felt how's the process been in the last year?
It's never easy. It's never comfortable. It's never happy. It's always grinding your teeth and saying that's bullshit and throwing shit away. And then there's people come by and say, you're throwing that away? and
talking about me.
Yes, I am. And, you know, several pictures, you know, have been saved from the fire, as it were, by Mark. And several pictures that Mark now owns have been saved from the fire. Mm-hmm. I'm not unhappy about that. I mean, he was right and I was wrong. You know, I'm very, very critical, as most artists are, and in the moment of finishing things, I'm very often hypercritical.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, just that is such bullshit, Clive. And the garbage can is really close by. And,
right.
You know, it's siren song calls to me, you know.
See, that's a mark. You got to be smart. You got to put the trash can, like, up the stairs.
Oh, it does. Right in the there is no garbage can, you know. But Mark is very smart about knowing what is preservable and what is genuinely, I think, am I right, genuinely not good.
Yeah, I'll agree that I'm very smart about many things.
Yeah, and that's true. And he'll engage me in a debate on occasion about what the values are of a picture.
Yeah.
And, you know, on occasion, I'll win the debate and the picture goes in the garbage, but not very often.
Do you get mad at a piece when you step back and look at it as a whole, or you go, there's this one little brushstroke that I just don't like, and now it's all ruined?
Actually, no. I'm at peace with that.
Okay.
I think denying the value of a piece for the sake of a brushstroke is perverse. What I will tend to do is not like a piece because I missed a sense of what it's for, a sense of its higher purpose, if you will. I don't have I will start out with a plan for what a picture is going to be or should be, and miss it by a mile, and then I just feel frustrated that I didn't say anything of worth in the picture, and that's irritating. But I will if I see something of worth and there's a couple of bad, you know, brushstrokes, hey, that's fine.
But are you the best person to determine what the worth is, do you think? Or should that be...
Probably not.
Right.
But I am the one sitting in the room with the painting. You know, and the knife.
Right.
The ultimate,
and the book of matches.
Exactly. The ultimate, you know, the ultimate choice is that lies with me. I'm a lot more conservative now about the judgments I make. Because... the book that you've just seen,
mm-hmm.
I left Thomas to make those choices about the pictures that are in that book. I think there are 75 paintings in there, are there something like that?
I think around
something
there,
like that.
Yeah.
You know, of many thousands.
Thomas Nicoven, our gallery, Clive's art representative.
Awesome man. And I felt like he was going to put this book together, he was going to fund it, he was going to make the whole thing, the package of aesthetics that it is. And I thought, well, you know, I should let him make the choice. If there's something I don't like, I'll kick and scream.
Yeah.
But there wasn't. The book came out pretty much with his choices intact, right?
Yeah.
And there were pictures in there that I'd actually thrown away.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you were okay with it?
Not many, I have to say. I mean, two, I think.
Yeah.
But there was one that I actually thrown away, and another which I'd forgotten about completely and had not even finished in my head. But actually, Thomas adored the picture. I mean, really, you know, argued vociferously for it. And that's where your point is exactly valid. And, you know, what does one person, you know, one person's, you know, meat is another person's poison.
Sure.
And I'm not perhaps the best person to judge. I came to painting late, as you know. I didn't start painting until I was in my 40s. Though I'd always been drawing and, you know, making sketches and things. I hadn't made any oil paintings or acrylics. I've certainly done nothing on this scale. Mm-hmm. And so it was. It's been a journey in the last 20 years to educate myself into what... Where the value of the work lies, you know? Is it important that I love it, or is it important that somebody else loves it? I think it's more important that somebody who's going to have it on their wall loves it than sure. I love it, you know? On the other hand, there are some pieces which I just cannot abide being in the world.
Of course.
You know? Such is life.
Well, that's the sort of interesting thing about, like, who is the art? Who is art for? Is it for the person telling the story, or is it for another? Because I'm sure a lot of times the baggage that you bring to something or the story yep. that you're trying to tell is not a maybe may not be at all what someone else sees because they bring their own set of circumstances. And experiences.
Inevitably, you know, you have to say if somebody's going to pay, you know, $50,000 for a picture,
right?
Yeah, they're going to like that picture. You know, they deserve to like that picture. On the other hand, if I'm painting the picture and it has my name on, I want to feel that I can justify its existence.
Of course.
You know?
And do you find that that's different? I mean, how does that feel different for you than writing now?
Same deal. Exactly the same deal. Exactly the same. You know, do I feel comfortable with... I won't give anything to people in the larger audience unless I'm comfortable with it, unless I know that it's good. On the other hand, if somebody comes to me later on and says, oh, God, I love... so-and-so, and I felt yeah, about it, then I won't consider myself educated.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever... Are you kind of in the process now of... You paint something, and then you go, I think I have to write about this.
Tell me what you mean by that.
So you construct a painting, you tell a story with
yes.
a painting, you go, you know what, I think I need to express this in a different medium. I need to tell a larger...
Well, Aberrat was that. Aberrat was always that. Aberrat was, you know... making paintings and then, oh wow, I need to tell stories about that. But that's the only time.
Yeah. And so where are you now? I mean, is there any ultimate goal, or is it just I just need to churn out as many pieces as I feel every day to...
I would withdraw from the word churn out.
Well, I mean, it just seems like the volume of paintings that you've done in the last year
yes.
feels like, you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's like... This is
it's
basically two or three a day.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of pictures. I agree. I can't stop. It's as simple as that. I can't stop.
What do you think would happen if Mark tied your hands down and like, you can't paint today? What do you think would happen to your brain?
I think I'd be, you know, on Thorazine pretty quickly. Seriously. I mean, I think that, you know, artists need an out for their imagination,
sure.
inevitably.
Has this helped the healing process?
I don't know. I don't even want to go there.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's too complex to ask. I mean,
yeah.
Or for me to know, put
yeah.
it that way.
Yeah. And how do you feel like you've evolved in the last year?
Same question. Ask my friends.
How's he evolved in the last year, Mark?
The paintings, I'd say, are different, but, I mean, they're fucking raw, and they're incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that there will be scores of paintings that you'll never show anyone that are just for you, or you want everyone to see them?
Not that I can conceive of, no. There'll be a few, inevitably.
Yeah.
But no. You should concentrate on this guy. He's getting away with murder here because he does have insights that he's not sharing with us.
What are you not sharing, Mark?
Nothing,
sitting over
nothing.
There all smug.
Just
how dare you?
Watching an interview.
What yeah, do you mean, guys? He's the one. He's been close to this process longer than anybody.
Yeah. What do you see, Mark?
I see. He's not kidding though. He would need Thorazine if I tied his hands down.
That's what I'm talking
yeah.
about. You know?
What have you learned?
I've learned from this man. I've learned how to be a better everything, a better writer, a better imaginer. I've learned that he sort of views the world like a man dreaming while he's awake.
Oh wow, that's a really good way to put that.
And And every time I give a tour of the office and I show them, you know, the paintings that are downstairs and everything that that he's accomplished, you know, that you have the 40 novels and paintings and dozens of films and you know, the body of work is so impressive. People say, "Geez, it makes me feel like I haven't done that much with my life." And I turn to them and I go, "No, you don't understand. It's not. It's just he can't not do it.
Right.
It's coming at him so fast that he just, it's all he can do to get it out in time.
Does it ever get annoying where you're like, please just give me a minute to not."
Clive nods.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. It gets exhausting. Totally exhausting.
Do you ever have to get up in the middle of the night and do it?
There isn't a middle of the night.
Okay.
that would connote sleep.
Yeah. You know, I work all the time. You know, I there is no middle of the night. There is no middle of the day. There's just time.
Bathroom breaks in between paintings.
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes I just piss on the canvas. Can we take a break for a moment?
Sure.
Yeah, I just want to prioritize.
We're gonna be fine.
Okay.
I think it's, you know, without focusing on health too much, it's just the way that these podcasts are gonna lay out is.
Yes.
I'm gonna put last year's up. And then tack this on to the end. It's like then we caught up a year later.
Got it.
Last year, you were very generous with your time, and at a certain point, you said, "You know what? I'm tired. I gotta go."
Yeah, absolutely.
And so we, just because of the nature of our schedules, we're here almost exactly a year later, and
right.
So it's just really interesting to catch up. And it was.
Where do you see the differences?
Well, first of all, you seem a lot more up.
Right.
Then you were, like, you could barely even get up the stairs last year.
Right, and
now you tooled up the stairs.
Yeah, back. Yeah.
And it was, I remember we were having this really interesting conversation about, you know, that when you came back, the direction we were heading in with the conversation was, you know, what was your first fear? Was it, is my mind is gone? I don't know if I'm going to have this art. And then you had it, and then that seemed to, you know, and you were, you almost got a little emotional, Mark. You were like, because obviously
ridiculous.
The relationship between you guys is so,
tight.
It's so tight and sweet and intimate and wonderful. And, you know, you were there. Like, you're basically, you're the family. Like, you guys, you know.
Family for each other.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, you have Stephanie and, like, you know, and I have, like, you know, my family, you know. But altogether, it's a single family, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
A brotherhood.
A brotherhood that turns into, you know, wives and husbands and, you know, and all those things. It seems to me that the commonality is making good art, mm-hmm. and I love. I love this man because he puts art before his own comfort, as I do, and I think that's kind of rare these days, you know, particularly in this town seems in love with its own ease,
mm-hmm.
its own comfort.
Yeah,
and this is the comfortable house to live in, I think.
Well, comfort can be dangerous. You know, when you get when you get too comfortable, then you're not inspired to grow, and when you're not growing, then you start to wither.
Yes, I mean it's particularly in movies. Movies are about the financial imperative.
Of
movies
course.
Is to actually do something that is going to make you lots of money. You'll make money for the studio, and if you don't do that the right way, you don't get to make another movie.
Right.
That's why I like paintings. That's why I like writing. When I start to paint, nobody is pushing me. Nobody is saying, okay, it has to be this way, it has to be that way.
Right.
I just go do it.
Right. You have full ownership over it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Whether they like it or not, I'm doing it.
Right.
It doesn't cost much to make.
Right.
You know, there isn't a massive overhead. And I just got the parrot telling me what to do out there. she's yelling, allow. It's allow. Mm-hmm.
Oh, there she was.
This household is about animals and people and art.
Yeah. I mean, it's so funny that, you know, there's so much... If you just looked at the art, you'd be like, wow, there's some dark themes here, but there's actually, but there's so much life in it at the same time.
I think that's well put. Where do you see the darkness particularly? Is it because people?
Well, this guy right here.
Yeah.
This mask here.
He was. It has to be said, a commission for the cover of Fangoria.
Oh, fantastic!
So he has particular, roots.
That was 8 years ago. That was actually the first night we
mentioned. Was it really?
Yeah, that was the first time you hinted. No, six years ago.
Wow.
And that was the very first hint that there might be a Nightbreed coming out.
You know, that's what's exciting is that, you know, we have so much coming down the pike. And then, you know, the Nightbreed thing is the big thing.
So you found a bunch of footage that you thought you lost.
We found all of it.
Yeah, we found everything.
Yeah.
And we found the whole movie.
Where?
All kinds of places. Where was the stuff that Fox had?
That was it was in some
Kentucky
vault. Yeah, in the middle of America.
How did you track that down?
It just we kept trying. Yeah, we finally found a distributor, Scream Factory. That was willing to front the costs of putting someone on the field to search for this, and they sent their workers out there, and we finally got a hit back.
Was it Kentucky?
I think it was like Ohio, something.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
I mean, we found some here, but it was very, very bad.
Yeah,
you know,
that
very
was
bad
VHS
quality,
footage we found. But that proved, that it existed. But what's bizarre is they only found the film footage. We didn't find any audio. So luckily, we found the VHS tapes, which had the audio.
Okay.
So it was this awesome restoration job where we have this,
And it is totally resurrected.
Yeah.
It's totally what it should be.
Yeah.
So you started from the ground up again with it?
I'm not going to say I did. He did.
Uh-huh.
Mark did. This is Mark's, great achievement. Well, one of Mark's great achievements is the reconstruction of a movie that I thought was, dead, face down in the water. I really did.
Yeah.
I didn't think it had a hope in hell of ever being reconstructed. Never mind totally, even a little bit.
Yeah.
As it turns out, it is totally reconstructed. It's sweet, man. It's sweet to actually look at it that way and see, wow, they tried to break this down, but it comes back. And it comes back because people wanted it, not just Mark, but the people who created the movement,
Occupy Midian.
The whole Occupy Midian site. I mean, that was ground roots, That was people who just wanted to see the movie again, wanted the movie to be visible to them the way that I intended it, and they never knew that, never seen that.
So what was your intention, and what was it that happened? Like, what was the disparity between those two points?
Oh, we need to sit down for a long time to talk about that, because it's actually a huge amount of difference between those two, between the movie that they put out, the bastardized movie that they put out, and the picture that we've now got, and which will come out on
we talk about it on the commentary track.
We
go into great detail.
It will be very clear to people when they see the movie, I think, how very different the picture is.
I can't wait to see it, because I saw Nightbreed in the theater. I remember seeing Nightbreed in the theater. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Absolutely. So, and I still remember it.
I think that's, it's lovely that you like the movie enough to remember it after all this time, but I think there's something we have waiting in the wings which is going to surprise you, which is that there's an emotional weight to the movie now, which there always was in my original intention.
Mm-hmm.
There's a love in the movie between Boone and Laurie, but between the audience and the Nightbreed, which was simply fucked up when it came out in the first version. Now I think we've got that. Now the love is intact. The love is back.
So was this sort of a love letter for you to reconstruct this?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me? I mean, it started out as a purely, interested perspective. I just wanted to see it.
Right.
When he gave me the green light to try and start looking for it, I was like a dog with a bone. Here we are 6 years later.
It took that long.
It took that long.
And it took a lot of disappointment.
Yeah.
you know,
a lot of no's, yeah. A lot of no one's going to want that. And
a lot of people say, I don't know where it is. Sorry, yeah. I have no idea where it is, you know?
And I don't care to try and find it.
And he was so dogged. He was so loving. He was so after this thing until he got it.
Yeah.
And
here we are.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I don't think I understood fully until the night we finished recording the commentary track, I pulled out my VHS copy. I was like, all right, now that we're here, can you sign this for me? And he looked at me and he goes, now that we're here, it doesn't hurt to sign these.
What if he was like, no.
I
don't
want to
sign anything right now.
I got
now.
Down on my knee.
Jesus Christ, I let you remake the movie. Now I got to fucking sign
what
this
box.
What
else do you want from me, Jesus for God's Christ. Sake?
It's a wonderful feeling.
What is this work of art back here of Dreams of Midian with the huge cock? That's a great piece. What is that?
That's our friends at Class Comics. When they heard we'd released the director's cut, they sent us a piece of a piece of art.
That is a great piece of art because I saw the rough drawing for it in the other room.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And
this
is
a finished ink piece.
That's so
is
fantastic.
That great?
Fantastic.
That is fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. They do erotic comic books.
Yeah, erotic comic books.
I mean, you know, when the people listening will understand this. When I say like, throbbing TARDIS blue cock, it's amazing.
TARDIS blue, I love that. Very specific.
It's a very specific color.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a very specific color.
Oh boy, I love that.
We love that. You love that.
So what's it comes out
October 28th.
October 28th.
Yeah.
And then, are you guys going to do an event or something around this?
Yeah. We've got some screenings lined up. We have one at Spectre Fest, which mm-hmm. is Elijah Wood's festival.
That'll be great.
At the Cine Family in the middle of October.
Are you going to travel or are you going to be traveling or can you?
I don't think so. Yeah. It'd be hard to do that, but you
try.
Know, I'll do my best. Yeah. I mean, you know, my heart is absolutely with this. I can't think of a project I feel more possessed by,
sure,
and more supportive of than this. This is the prodigal son.
Is this as satisfied as you can ever possibly feel? Because you must mostly feel dissatisfaction a lot of the time.
It
right?
feels very satisfying. Yes, it does. It really does. It feels just like a sweet revenge.
Are you okay with feeling satisfied, or is that weird?
I'm not touching that. just pass me a cigarette. We'll talk about it later.
Okay, good. I just mean, you know, a lot of times it's, you know, you.
No, I'm kidding. I know what you
mean. Yeah, yeah.
Of course, it's satisfying. You know, once in a while, you want to feel it came out the way you wanted it to come out.
Right.
It doesn't matter if what next time it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, you. I feel like you need. You know, obviously you don't get those every time, but you need them every so often to keep going. Like,
otherwise,
okay, it's possible.
Yeah, it's all a dark tunnel, isn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, it's a good feeling.
Good.
It's a good feeling.
So what's your schedule for the rest of the day? Are you going to chat with someone else and then paint some more?
There's a desk waiting for me and a painting waiting for me. And next door, if Mark will take you through as you go past the dogs, you'll see that's where all the paintings reside on the way out to the next room.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot more paintings.
And the book,
Imaginer.
The book is gorgeous.
Thank you.
And thank you for signing it for me.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you for this.
No, of course. I mean, listen, I feel like I want to check in on you every so often to make sure you
do so.
To make sure you're
Please,
doing okay.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.
So in general, because you know, obviously the way the last podcast left off,
yes,
people would be very worried about you.
Yes, yes. They don't need to be worried. I'm here and I'm doing my thing.
Good.
Yeah, yeah.
And you feel like the determination with which you went after Nightbreed is essentially like that's the spark that's keeping you
going. That's evidence, I think, of where my head is at.
Yeah.
You know, don't fuck with me. I'm still alive.
I mean, that's what is it like? What is it? Do you think about what's inside you that makes that happen? Because so many people could have given up. So many other people could have said, fuck this. I just don't feel like doing anything. Like, what is it that keeps you going?
I never analyze those things, because if I do, I think they'd sort of die inside me. I prefer to just get on and do it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So just be.
Just be, and don't ask too many questions. Martin knows this. I'm very much an anti.
So you don't get in the way.
Yeah, I don't get in the way of myself.
Yeah.
You know? Really hard to do sometimes, though. Like, how the fuck do you get out of your own brain's way sometimes?
Very hard, I agree. But on the other hand, the best thing I think you can do is hope that your instinct is correct.
Mm-hmm.
And just leave yourself to do what it. Leave your guts to do what they know best.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to work for me for the last 30 years or so, and I'm going to leave it that way.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you again for sitting down and chatting with us and catching
pleasure.
Up. And
my
then,
pleasure.
We'll check in with you. And then when, you know, when Nightbreed comes out,
yeah.
I really would love to see it on the big screen.
Well,
so if you're doing it at CineFamily, then I got to sneak in there.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what you think when you've seen it.
I honestly can't wait.
Yeah. It's pretty fucking awesome.
Well, good. Yeah. Well done.
And that's to that man. That's really short. That all kudos to Mark, because really this thing would not have happened without Mr.
Well, it's nice to see Mark smiling this time, because last time there was definitely this, like, you know, I could see the, you know, like the weight of everything.
It's been a long journey for all of us.
To see, you know, like, well, here we are, you know.
Yeah.
We made it.
Yeah, you're saying, we made it. And Mark said, but no, we're here. We're you know, onward and upward.
Excellent.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks everyone.
Guys.
Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
I have missed these Friday night dinners.
Welcome to Harvey Graw.
At these family dinners,
gracious everyone,
dysfunction is served.
I can't have you all messing things up for my entire adult life.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we embarrass you?
Jump, jump, jump.
It's already better than I dared to dream.
They're extra.
Let the wild rumpus start!
Woo, 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 woo.
And they're embarrassing.
We know how hard it is to move on from the first girl that you ever slept with.
Not the first girl who I ever slept with.
Yeah, right. You're a regular
lady killer.
I thought you said it was going to be boring here tonight.
No!
I really hope it would be.
But they couldn't love each other more.
Surprise! It's Mom and Dad being totally normal.
Wow.
So, dinner next Friday, everyone?
Wouldn't miss for the world.
Dinner with the Parents, Season 1. Stream free only on Freevee.